Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. This is Chuck Morse here at Chuck Morse Speaks. We'll be joined shortly by Gaurav Bala. He is an entrepreneur. He is a business consultant. And he sent me a very interesting notification here with regard to a topic he wants to discuss, and that was the lessons that can be learned from the raid on the home of Osama bin Laden. What sort of leadership messages can we derive from that? He advises businesses. He's one of these types who sort of he thinks outside the box, so to speak, and is able to help businesses develop new strategies. His book is Collaboration and Co-Creation. It says here on his website, by encouraging business companies to adopt a disciplined process to innovate continuously, by identifying and by helping remove the obstacles that prevent innovation from flowing freely, and by keeping the company focused on continuous customer value creation that results in new value for the customer and sustainable profitability, he is brought in as a consultant to take a look not only at specific operations as they may develop regarding business situations, but an overall philosophical and practical look at the business itself and how it functions. We should be receiving a call from him shortly. I mean, I know that I've suggested that he call in, but we'll see how that goes. Believing that knowledge is power, Gaurav Bala discusses cutting-edge lessons to be learned from the raid at Abbottabad and how those lessons could be applied towards solving complex. This is the anniversary, May 1st, of the raid, in which Osama bin Laden was killed, as were several others. CNN, of course, carried a special interview with President Obama recently. A number of significant leadership and decision-making lessons emerged from that interview, with President Obama providing an insider's perspective on the entire operation. We can certainly derive those self-same leadership lessons as we look at that situation and other situations. My examination of it, from the only question that I walked away from that with was, besides the fact, of course, that our military personnel operated with enormous professionalism and bravery, was how did it come about that Osama bin Laden was living in public for years near the capital city of Pakistan, and that people in the neighborhood kind of knew who he was and knew that what was going on over there. And yet, it was overlooked. I mean, it kind of goes to the fact that people can, I suppose, hide out in clear view and function normally or relatively normally. I mean, a good example of that in our own country recently was none other than Whitey Bulger. He lived out in the open for years. I actually was myself in Santa Monica at the time that Whitey Bulger lived there, and I recall walking around near the pier with the beaches, and there's a pier, and I spotted him. But it was so out of context. It's like, what? You know, you assume that Whitey Bulger is probably off in some, you know, offshore island somewhere hiding out, and you know that the FBI was putting all these resources into finding him. What in the world would he be doing walking down the beach near the Santa Monica Pier, of all places, looking just like an old grandfather? But so I looked over, because I'm from Boston, and I knew who Whitey Bulger was, not personally, but just in general. And I said, holy mackerel, that's Whitey Bulger. But it didn't really occur to me that it actually was. So, you know what they say, who are you going to believe? Your lying eyes or what they tell you? And in this case, it wasn't that anyone was telling me anything, but I just sort of looked him over and said, okay. and just assumed that I wasn't seeing what I was seeing and moved on. But the fact is, in retrospect, that I really did see Whitey Bulger. And had I been a little bit more cognizant of these sorts of situations, that somebody can be who you think they are, that you should go with your gut, that I could have turned him in and got a big fat reward. But anyway, the fact, I bring this up only in the context that people can function and exist in all sorts of settings without necessarily bringing attention upon themselves, without being noticed. And that's exactly what happened there and in that case. So to me, it's an interesting lesson, and maybe that correlates with the Bin Laden situation. Why would anybody think that Bin Laden, the most wanted man in the world, someone that intelligence agencies from all over the world had coordinated with each other to find and to search out, and probably somebody who was living in a state, either in a cave somewhere, or in such a state of heightened military alert that to reach him would be like crossing into a war zone, to put it mildly, with all sorts of high-tech weaponry and equipment, that in fact he was just living in a suburb of Islamabad, the capital of Pakistan, in a relatively nondescript house with a wall around it, which is not atypical in that part of the world for wealthy people. And that it was right in the broad daylight. He'd go out and do some shopping, and walk around town. Nobody thought twice about it. So to my way of thinking, that's a lesson to be derived from the raid in Abbottabad. But we'll have to hear from Gaurav Bala about that, if he does join us, and I don't know if he's going to because he's not here yet. And, of course, that's the way it goes sometimes with podcasts. People come and they go. You don't always have I've had this happen countless times. Anyway, what else is going on in the world since I'm here and since I've got the attention of the listener? It seems to me that the scandals and the corruption accusations surrounding Hillary Clinton are further metastasizing every day. There was a major domino fall in Virginia about a week ago when the sleazebag governor, former Clinton hack and bagman, someone who had collected monies for them and worked their criminal-like organization for many decades, that being Terry McAuliffe, is now being accused of taking a large sum of money from a foreign agent, of this man from communist China, in violation of federal law, and that the FBI has questioned him. And he says, I'm shocked that I would be questioned about such a thing. I actually am kind of shocked myself. You'd think that somebody of that level, it's like the Clintons themselves, that they know how to do that. The Clintons have always been one step ahead of the law. They know how to work the system in such a way that they can't be caught. They're brilliant lawyers. And, of course, the Clintons in particular have always been able to get away with this because they have genuflected properly to the left. Therefore, they're given a pass. Therefore, since they do the bidding of the liberal left establishment, the media, the law enforcement, the justice system, the culture in general tends to ignore it, tends to look the other way, and even in some cases tends to justify it by saying, hey, I don't care if the Clintons are making a few bucks. They are heroes of the people, So they're entitled. And thus they're able to march along decade after decade, all the way back to the days when they were co-governors in Arkansas and a high executive at Tyson Foods, which is one of the largest corporations in Arkansas, helps Hillary Clinton turn $1,000 into $100,000 on the cattle futures exchange in Chicago. And then a few months later, Bill Clinton, as governor, suddenly deregulates a certain portion of the industry for Tyson Chicken so that Tyson Chicken could then dump about a ton of chicken shit in the state rivers. That's the kind of thing that the Clintons are famous for. And you know, is it all catching up to them finally after all these decades? I don't know. I think it actually would be a miracle if it did. But there are several shoes dropping around her. She hasn't given a press conference yet this year because of it. And the FBI, Obama's FBI, in spite of the fact that they probably don't want to do it, either have to indict her or they're going to have to not indict her, in which case it's going to be a major scandal in and of itself. And I think that they are weighing and measuring that. The illegal activity around the private server is growing in that now we have information, yesterday even, that the State Department had deleted a portion of a video that they had previously carried on their website because it was politically embarrassing. It was a situation by which one of the assistants to Hillary Clinton in the State Department had said that that they did lie about the situation around the negotiations for the nuclear deal with Iran, you know, which is embarrassing. But that was when they went to look for that clip, they found that it had been deleted. Now, that's illegal. That's a violation of the records laws. Somebody could go to jail for that. That's a crime, records, you know, without a process by which you get permission to do that. So far at the State Department, nobody's stepping forward to say who did it. But it's just one more small piece, and in this case, that's not even a big one, around this miasma of corruption and lies that has always surrounded that couple. What's going to happen? Well, I think that the situation looks to me like almost a Watergate-type situation if Clinton wins the presidency. You already have growing scandals. You already have investigations now by, I think, two different branches of the federal government. You've got the FBI investigation into the emails. You've got a congressional investigation into the Clinton Foundation, which is one of this massive corruption scandal, this slush fund, and where they might pull the nonprofit status from them, since they've only given, I believe it was 7% of their money to charity. What are they doing with the rest of those billions and millions of dollars? That's a question that we'll never get. That's a pit that we'll never reach the bottom of. But we know that Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea are multi-millionaires being paid fees and salaries and emoluments from those foundations, and that monies from those foundations have been used to help, let's just say, help their friends and punish their enemies, right? I mean, it's obviously not being used for charity. But on top of that, of course, you've got the speaking fees to Goldman Sachs and other organizations. Peter Schweitzer, who's done a lot of research on this and is a good investigative reporter, has released a list by name of the organizations that paid Hillary Clinton anywhere from $150,000 to $500,000 to speak, and that list includes players in the United States. Goldman Sachs gave her $250,000, $300,000 three times or four times, and when she gets that kind of money to speak at an event, it's not just, by the way, the money itself, which is a huge sum, but she also gets, you know, first-class plane tickets. They pick her up at the airport in a limousine. They take her to a $5,000 a night hotel. They drive her back to the airplane in a limousine. They probably throw in a few meals. I mean, it's everything. I mean, this is like a huge payoff. And Clinton did, both Clintons, did these speaking engagements for several years, accumulating last year an estimate of $50 million apiece for these speaking fees. Now, to think that Bernie Sanders has done a very effective job of bringing this up and pointing out that this means that Hillary Clinton is owned lock, stock, and barrel by Wall Street corporations. And by the way, this is not an attack on private business, but it is an attack on a politician who obviously is willing to sell her office in exchange for money. Because why else would they be giving $250,000 a pop just to hear her speak? Do you think it's because she's so interesting that, oh, I want to hear what she has to say? She's so dynamic. And anyone who's heard her speak knows otherwise. It's because she's Secretary of State, and she can influence or, if not, affect regulations that could help those respective industries, both domestically and around the world. Or, to leaving office, she was the presumptive or seriously considered candidate for the presidency, in which case she can again influence public opinion, not public opinion, but public policy, excuse me. And that this is how the Clintons rolled. I mean, this is what they did as president of the United States. This is what they did all the way back, as I mentioned, to the days in the mansion in Arkansas, that they use their office to enrich themselves, knowing that the media isn't going to do anything about it because they genuflect to the left. Believe me, if they were conservatives, they would have been in the can a long time ago. I mean, the former governor, by the way, of Virginia, who came before McAuliffe, he is in the can right now for having taken a gift that I think was worth maybe $50,000, something very minor compared to Clinton. And, if he had been a liberal Democrat like McAuliffe, he'd probably get away with it. So that shows the double standards. And I think that if she's elected president of the United States, and I do think that there's a very high likelihood that she will be because of the powers behind her. And by the way, she just attacked Donald Trump for being against the world order. Okay, so that's a dog whistle to the international establishment. And those are people who know how to get someone in office. If she is elected to the presidency, yet, because of this huge confluence of scandals, corruption that involves serious crimes, things that most people would go to jail for, and that's only the tip of the iceberg. We don't even know as they dig deeper and deeper. I would predict that it's going to be like Watergate. It's going to be a revisiting of Watergate. And, of course, Richard Nixon's crimes are nothing in comparison. I mean, they're minor. You know, yes, he did, he had people breaking into the Watergate Hotel for reasons that are still not entirely known, and we don't even know if he knew about it. In fact, it was said at the time that he found out about it by reading the Sunday papers, and when he saw that, he hit the roof. He did arrange for the IRS to look into some files and to do a few audits. Nothing compared to the IRS scandal around Obama, by the way. And we don't know what Clinton apparently was doing the same thing when he was president of the United States. So if you want to talk about money, holy mackerel, take a look at the Clintons. So I think that the confluence of events is going to lead to another Watergate. She'll be elected, and then she'll be impeached, or she'll have to step down like Nixon did in exchange for her successor giving her a pardon, which was what Gerald Ford did for Nixon after he stepped down. Thus, she won't have to go to prison. So, I think that if we are going to elect her, that's what's going to happen. And because of the ongoing investigation, which apparently is reaching a critical mass, from what I understand, the FBI is interviewing people now and offering immunity from prosecution in exchange for testimony and several other and other situations. They do seem to be moving in on it. That she very well may not be the nominee. According to a poll that just came out today, there's a report on it on the Drudge Report, Bernie Sanders has pulled even with her and is actually 1 point ahead of her in California. And that primary is Tuesday. And believe me, if she loses the California primary to Bernie Sanders, that's, yes, she'll have enough delegates no matter what. And she'll continue to, get delegates even though she continues to lose. But the stench of that is going to be so powerful. The fact that she continues to, we wake up the next day after seeing Bernie Sanders win a primary and she has more delegates. That I think that could be the death knell for her candidacy. I think that she might be, there'll be an increased amount of pressure to have her step aside, to have her suspend her campaign. And since the establishment does not want Bernie Sanders, pretty much for the same reason that they don't want Donald Trump, but Trump has already pulled it off, they're going to try to find somebody else to step in take over the nomination from Hillary. And there are several people that are just there, you know, ready to go. Obviously Biden, maybe John Kerry. I don't know who else they can dig up. But, you know, there's going to be a line of people who are ready to jump because nobody wants, because they don't want to have Sanders. Of course, if they do have Sanders, and if Sanders is, and his Sandinistas are running against Donald Trump, that is going to be a very interesting race. That is going to be a capitalist versus a communist. When I say communist, I don't mean a communist with a capital C. I mean, I don't think Bernie Sanders is a member of the Communist Party. I don't even think he is that far left to be a communist. I mean it more as in, you know, sort of philosophically, in the soft sense, what he represents and what he believes in. And if we have an election like that, where you have really a strong and definable contrast between two candidates, then that could lead to a real national debate and a national referendum on the future of the country. And to my way of thinking, that would be a very exciting development. I think that Sanders would lose in a landslide once Trump and people in the Republican Party start to unearth his various beliefs over the years and the things that he stood for. Because the American people, while they may be liberal at times, or they may think they're liberal, or they may even vote liberal, they're not interested, I believe, in the setting up of a socialist state, you know, which would really require a complete abrogation and redefinition of the Constitution. I don't think that that's something that more than at most, in a worst case scenario, maybe 20% of the American people would support. And maybe Sanders, you know, by getting some other sort of types, you know, I don't know, the anti-Wall Street crowd, whoever, 30%. But never more than that. Even with the recent generational dumbing down of the country, that's just not on the cards in America, at least not now. And it is because we still are a nation that operates on self-interest, on individual freedom. We would care about our own freedom and that of our children and of our family and of our futures. And everyone knows that the socialism is just not something that's practical. It's not the way to go. Even most people on the left understand that. We could look no further than recent events in Venezuela to know that. I mean, Venezuela is amongst one of the richest countries in the world. They're the number fourth or number fifth producer of oil in the world. They don't even have enough money or enough resources that people can't even get toilet paper. You know, I mean, there's blackouts and there's brownouts every night because they don't have enough electricity. This, again, is in a country that has about more oil production than most countries in the world. We also have seen the collapse of socialism now in Brazil with the impeachment of Rousseff. Brazil is, again, I mean, they've imploded on their own rock. And I predict that the winds of freedom, the winds of change, not the kind of change Obama was talking about, the real change, are wafting north. And I think that they will eventually waft their way into our own nation just in time for the November election. And that will mean the election of Donald Trump as president of the United States, I think by a pretty handy margin, whether his opponent is Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, or perhaps a third figure. And I feel excited about that. I think it's going to be a great change for this country. You know, Donald Trump is an imperfect messenger, for sure. He is a bore. He is a self-centered twit. Look, there's a lot of things that we can not like about Donald Trump as a person. But the fact is that the reason he's doing well, and this is something the media doesn't like to discuss, is that he actually is bringing up real issues that resonate with people, not only on the surface, but in a deep way. And that those issues are good issues. They are things like having a positive economic policy that ensures that America has an advantage when trading with other nations, so that we don't have a trade deficit with China that threatens the value of our dollar and that threatens our domestic industries. He has a message in a way similar to Bernie Sanders in that companies and corporations will be penalized if they go overseas and then ship back products to us and dump them back onto our shores, that they are going to be given an incentive to stay here and a punishment if they leave. Those are traditional American functions. That's what Congress is supposed to do. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3 of the Constitution gives Congress the right to regulate trade policy and tariff policy. And this has been an issue that's been picked up in every election except maybe in the past decade or so. Trump wants to do that. He wants to have trade policies that, while still protecting the concept of free trade, they put the United States in an advantageous position. He understands that we can use our leverage as still the strongest economy in the world to make sure we get the best deal when it comes to trade. That'll preserve American labor. It'll preserve American jobs. I think that Donald Trump is going to make a major play for American labor, and that'll increase if Hillary is the candidate, because I think Bernie Sanders makes that same play, and he stands for many of these same policies. As far as the business of protecting America's borders from illegal aliens, he wants to raise the standard of who visits the United States and who comes here, so that we know that people who are coming here are going to contribute. They're not enemies. They're not going to kill us. They're not criminals. They're not terrorists. But that they want to come here because they want to work and they want to be Americans and they want to contribute to our society. Those are basic standards that any sovereign nation has with regard to those who immigrate into their countries. And we don't have that as long as we don't secure our borders, as long as we don't regulate who is coming in here. We don't even know who's here. The media is going to say, oh, this is because he has something against people because of their race. And I don't think anyone's buying that. No one believes that, except maybe the hard left. And I think that Trump is going to make inroads, by the way, and has made inroads in that regard, into minority communities who are being told that Trump has something against them because of their race, which, of course, is a lie. Anyway, we're reaching toward the end of the program, so I want to thank you for listening this afternoon. Let me just take this opportunity to mention that my new book is available at Amazon or Amazon Kindle. It is Communism is Not Dead, the Communist Conspiracy in the 21st Century. And you can get that by putting my name in the server, Chuck Morse, Morse like Morse code, and you will get up on Amazon a nice page. The cover is fantastic. I actually hired a guy from Pakistan to create it. It's great. And that is Communism is Not Dead, the Communist Conspiracy in the 21st Century, my new book. So I want to thank you for listening this afternoon, and have a nice day, everybody.